Well, let's open our Bibles to Proverbs. We will be in chapter 6 this evening. Proverbs chapter 6. Have you ever noticed how some people who seem to be of rather average intelligence, that's not an insult, just a normal reality. Average is average, and that's why most people fall into that category. Some people who are of rather average and maybe even a little below average IQ in this world still very often live lives that are profoundly productive, blessed, peaceful, strong, happy. Not that they never have difficulties, not that they never have trials and traumas. These enter into every life. It's an interesting thing. When you contrast that with sometimes the case of people who are extremely gifted, have very high IQs, are genius, and have other areas of their lives, maybe one or two, in which they're extremely outstanding, but then you find out their life is a shambles behind the scenes. Maybe they have all kinds of popularity, all kinds of power and prestige, all kinds of money, as a result of being particularly gifted in a particular way. And yet when their story is told, you find, and this is often the case, especially among people who are celebrities, people who have been made famous by Hollywood and so on, you find out that their stories were really very sad behind the scenes. And you think to yourself, well, I thought I wanted to be like that person. Now I find out that their life was rotting from the inside in so many different ways, and they died tragically, sometimes at their own hand, as a result of the hopelessness that sets in. Now, what is the deal here? Because in our world, we tend to think that IQ and education are what really matters. You know, that's really playing the percentages. That's what's going to bring success. And yet, when you really look around at the world, and you really look at it in another way besides the way the world sees itself, and it's forever patting itself on the back. I don't know if you've noticed that. The world is always patting itself on the back. But when you look deeper than that, find out there are a lot of people who have really what we would call average or not spectacular lives, yet behind the scenes they're wonderful lives. You peel back the layers, even sometimes layers of difficulty, you find strength, you find peace. That's interesting, isn't it? What's the difference between those two lives? Is it IQ? Is it giftedness? Is it the advantages that whatever the world has to offer, can offer? Is that the difference? Actually, no. In the Bible, and the Bible describes both kinds of people, the Bible says the difference is very simply this: wisdom and knowledge. Wisdom and knowledge. People who have wisdom and knowledge are able to live well, and people who don't have it are not able to live well. And when it says knowledge, it does not mean IQ. Incidentally, IQ would have meant nothing to Solomon. They didn't have IQ tests. IQ tests only test your ability to excel in a particular educational system. That's the limit of IQ tests. It would have made no difference to Solomon at all. When he talks about knowledge and wisdom, he's talking about what we would call, in a sense, horse sense about life. It's talking about how to live well, how to make decisions that make your life worthwhile. From walking with God, which is the very first decision that makes your life worthwhile, all the way down to how you spend your money and how you talk and all these other things. That's in the Bible. That's what makes the difference between a life that when you peel back the outward layers, you find quality, and one in which when you peel back the outward, sometimes very successful layers, you find rot. You ever cut down a tree and find that everything was dead on the inside of that tree except about the last 8 inches or so? And it looks so strong and it looks so powerful. That's often the case with the great big oaks that we have around here. You cut into them. In fact, we had one fall on our property a while back as a result of a storm. And it was a really powerful looking oak tree. I mean, it looked like that thing's going to stand there forever. It's big around and everything. And it fell and it was rotten on the inside. Well, you see, what the Bible would say about a life that's rotten on the inside is it has no real wisdom and no real knowledge. It doesn't understand Proverbs, doesn't understand how to think like God. Versus a life that has stability and strength, and it really is what it looks like. Now, it's interesting because the decisions that make the difference between wisdom and lack of wisdom really are not about IQ, but they do involve four common themes. And if you think about these kinds of things, you might want to write it down, and these might surprise you. The kinds of decisions that reveal real wisdom and knowledge, a real understanding of life, a real horse sense about how to live, are these kinds of decisions. They share four things in common. First of all, they are simple decisions. Isn't that interesting? The decisions that shape your life really are rather simple daily decisions. They're not the most profound ones. They're the simple ones. They're not very complex. You might wrestle over a complex decision, take a long time to make it, but that decision may very well not alter your life very much at all. On the other hand, earlier in the day, you may have made a very seemingly simple decision that altered the direction of your life for a long time. We'll see how that works. The decisions that show real wisdom are really the simple ones. We get the complex decisions, the huge business decisions that people make maybe once or twice in their lifetime, get a lot of airtime and a lot of prayer. But they're not the ones that shape life. It's the simple decisions. And that brings us to the second thing. Daily. These decisions are daily. They happen every day. There are a lot of decisions you make every day that show whether you have wisdom and knowledge or not. Or if you have the wisdom and knowledge, whether you're living by it. And they are the simple decisions. And secondly, they are the daily decisions. They're the ones in which you deal with it every single day. Some people will ignore the daily decisions of their lives. They don't care what they watch on TV. They don't care what they eat. They don't care how they spend their daily life. And they'll focus their entire attention on some humongous decision that's coming down the pike that they're worried about. Spend a lot of prayer on that one and give up on a lot of daily ones, when in reality what's shaping their life right this minute is the daily one. It's just a simple little daily one that you didn't give much thought to, that you didn't give much prayer to. But that's the one that shows whether or not you're living a wise life, a life that's going to actually work. And that's how it is, by the way, that some people can make profoundly successful large decisions and at the end of their life have a life that, because of all the small daily decisions, is rotten on the inside and caves in from its own weight. And you find out afterwards in their obituary, in their biographies written by other people, you find out, wow, that guy made a lot of bad decisions on a daily basis. So they're simple. These decisions that show wisdom or not, they're simple and they are daily. How to spend the next 20 minutes, how to spend the next hour, how to spend leisure time. That's not a big decision, how to spend leisure time. Or is it? How you spend your leisure time actually probably shapes your life more than how you spend your work time. Think about it. Think about it. What risks occur in leisure, and we don't give it much thought. And these things happen every single day, and they're simple, and they're daily. And here's another thing you'll find, and by the way, this is all right out of Proverbs. That's why Proverbs is so daily and so practical. All of these thoughts come out of the book of Proverbs. They're simple decisions, they're daily decisions. Number three, you will find that they are all, or most of the shaping ones, are moral decisions. In other words, they're decisions whether or not to do something that is right. Is it the right thing to do? Well, it's expedient. Now, I didn't ask that. Is it right? Is it the right decision? I mean, morally right to do this. You will find that decisions that shape and decisions that show wisdom are very often, in fact, almost always, moral decisions of some sort. They affect morality and ethics, doing what is right. And then finally, you will find that they are relational. Relational. And boy, Proverbs has a lot to say about this. And this is, again, it has to do with how you relate to other people. Decisions you make that relate to the people around you, family, friends, husband, wife, kids, parents, how you speak, what you do. A snap decision concerning a close friend can ruin your life. And sometimes people don't even give it a thought. It has to do with relational things. And you've noticed in Proverbs so far how many of the Proverbs have to do with how you relate to the people around you, how you deal with them, how you function with them. Now, with that in mind, we'll move into chapter 6, because there are five things that we'll find, and we're only going to do chapter 6. We covered five chapters last week. We're going to cover one chapter this week. But there's five things in this chapter, and they kind of break up into a nice little outline, so that's why I'm going to just spend our time in Proverbs 6. So I've got Hebrews on the brain, too, see, in Proverbs 6. And what they are, what these are, is five things to be on guard against. And I'll give them to you as we work through it. And you might find them just as you're walking through the passage. If you outline it all, these will pop out at you. But they're five things in terms of character to be on guard against when you're making daily decisions. And then we'll turn it around and see some advice at the end. But Proverbs is about wisdom, which means not IQ. It's about how to live wisely, how to make your life work, how to make it function properly. And there are five things in chapter 6 that if you'll take them to heart, boy, it'll help your life tremendously. The first one, verses 1 through 5, is this. Guard against, or be on guard in your character, about rash commitments. Rash commitments. Now look at verse 1. My son, if you have become a surety for your neighbor, you've given a pledge for a stranger. If you've been snared with the words of your mouth, and have been caught with the words of your mouth. What a great picture. Snared and caught are both pictures that they would use of catching an animal. So you say, the picture is, out of your mouth comes words in which you make a promise or a vow or some sort of, you say something and it goes out and it gets bigger and bigger and then it comes back and then it completely envelops you and closes and hoists you up like one of those man traps in the jungle, and you're stuck in this thing. And you say, you know what? If I hadn't have said that then, or if I hadn't have promised that then, I wouldn't be in this now. That's what he's talking about. So do this then, my son, and deliver yourself. If you find yourself in this mess, deliver yourself, since you've come into the hand of your neighbor. You've come under his power. You promised something, and now you can't come through. You've come into the hand of your neighbor. Go, humble yourself. Importune, that's an old word used here in the New American Standard, but it's a great word. It means beg. It means beg and grovel and say, please, let me off the hook. I made a promise, and I can't keep it. That's what he means. Go and humble yourself and beg your neighbor. And do not give sleep to your eyes nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand, like a bird from the hand of the fowler. What he's saying is this, and in the context, the specific context is when you make a commitment that you didn't think about ahead of time. You made it for whatever your reason, but it was a rash commitment. Now you find out you can't keep it. What he's saying is, get out of it now. Do not stick around out of sheer pride. But go to this person that you promised that you would do something for, or go to the person that you said you would guarantee their loan. Surety actually means it's like co-signing a loan. And he says, you catch yourself co-signing a loan for somebody you don't know well enough to know they'll pay it off, and you find out, oh no, I'm in a mess now. He says, get yourself out of that mess, even if it costs you your pride. Which in this culture, by the way, much more so than in our culture, the word was the bond and the pride kept everything going. And what he's saying is, humble out, admit that you made a mistake as soon as possible, and get out of that mess that you got yourself into. And the interesting thing is that rash commitments get people into a lot of trouble. What we say in general gets us into a lot of trouble. Implied commitments, saying, well, I'll do this or I'll do that, gets us into a lot of trouble. And we don't think about it. You want to live wisely? Watch out for those rash commitments. You know, it's interesting too, because why do we make rash promises? There's a couple of reasons why people often make rash promises. Aside from maybe wanting something out of the interaction or out of the transaction, but sometimes we make rash promises because we're unwilling to say no. And a lot of times that's a pride issue. We don't want to say no to somebody. They ask us for something. They say, will you do this? And in something inside says, you know, this is not better judgment. You really shouldn't do this. But we, oh man, I don't want to say no. And so we end up saying yes to something that we really know we're going to be sorry for committing to, but then we're stuck with it. The inability to say no. You know, it's a really good skill. The ability to say no nicely. I mean, some people have taken, you know, the classes on how to say no, and they don't do it all that well. They need another class on how to say it nicely. You got to say it nicely. It's a good thing to be able to do. No, I'm sorry, I can't do that. That would get you out of some real trouble. Here's another reason people make rash commitments, and a desire to impress others. You're in a situation in which you want to appear impressive. You want to come across well, and someone asks you something, maybe in public. Other people are standing around. They want to hear your answer. And instead of humbling out and saying, you know, I really can't do that, or I really shouldn't do that, or let's talk about that later, give me time to think about it, you kind of blurt it out. Have you ever said anything where as the words were leaving your lips, you were saying to yourself, you idiot, what are you saying? Catch those words before they reach the ears. And the speed of sound, you know, being what it is, it's just like, I can't believe I said that. I can't believe. Now I'm going to have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to unsay it later. We want to impress. We want to impress. Be careful about that. Make your decisions a little more slowly. Even if it's not impressive to make a decision slowly. Even if other people seem flashier and that they're giving everybody what they want to hear and everything, but you're not sure you can do it, well, just back off then. And sometimes say no even to a good request if you know you can't do it. I tell you, where this hits me most powerfully, and it's you can't get more practical in terms of making life work than this area of overcommitment, where you say yes to too many good things and then later have to back away from some of them. And often this happens in ministry, and often it happens among Christians who are multi-talented. It is the multi-talented people who get asked to do a lot of stuff, and then they say yes to a lot of stuff, and sometimes they forget that they are not the Messiah. They only work for him, remember? And then it's very embarrassing, and pride keeps them going because they just can't say no once they've started saying yes. So swallow your pride. Swallow the pride and say, I got to get out of this. I got to simplify. I got to say no to some things. That's okay to do. Now, in the context, he's talking about co-signing for someone else, but the application goes beyond that. It goes into the whole area of rash commitments. Isn't that practical? Isn't that practical? I mean, the Bible's full of practical things. It's full of all kinds of how to think kind of stuff. Here's a real practical word. Be careful with rash commitments, overcommitments, not thinking and praying before you say yes to something. Here's the second one, verses 6 to 11, and I'm going to call it chronic laziness. Go to the ant, O sluggard. Observe her ways and be wise, which having no chief, officer, or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provisions in the harvest. It's interesting because what it means is with nobody hounding her and nobody telling her what to do, she lives wisely. Go to the ant. Look at how the ant functions. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? And when you arise from your and when will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And your poverty will come on you like a vagabond, and your need like an armed man. What he's saying is there are excuses people use. Oh, no, I'm just resting. I'm just resting. And some people are just resting always. And he's saying, laziness, that's what he's getting after here. Now, most of the people I know and function with are not lazy. And at first when I read this, I thought to myself, you know, who does this really apply to? But then I thought, you know, there's a deeper reality too. In another sense, all of us tend to procrastinate about the things that really need to be done, don't we? And that's a form of really emotional laziness. And an unwillingness to face the situations that must be faced and deal with the situations that must be dealt with and do what needs to be done. Some people who work really hard in terms of physical work are nevertheless extremely lazy in anything that requires emotional effort, anything that requires something to be done now. And they won't do it. They just won't do it. Be careful of laziness at every level of life. He says, take a page out of the ant's journal. They know what needs to be done, and they do it even though nobody tells them. Nobody hounds them. Nobody harps on them. Do you do what needs to be done in your life, even if nobody hounds you to do it? If even if your parents don't tell you what to do, do you do what you need to do because you see that it needs to be done? You know, that's a mark of maturity in life. It's a mark of immaturity when your life basically is a wreck until someone else straightens it up for you. It's a mark of maturity to say, wait a minute, my life, my room needs to be cleaned. My bills need to be paid. My car needs to be serviced. And then says, after I finish that, then I'll play. See? And sometimes even people who don't appear to be lazy internally, actually, are quite lazy. In fact, my secretary, Anne, has what she calls the lazy man's load, which is as much stuff as you can put into your arm. She says, I'm carrying the lazy man's load down the hall, because she doesn't want to make another trip back down the hall because she's too late. She says this, you know, I'm too lazy to go back down the hall. So she says, I'm carrying a lazy man's load. And the first time she said it, I had to think about it for a minute because it looked like she was carrying so much. But it really was a lazy man's load. Actually, she was being lazy because she did not want to do it right, which would take longer, making her carry two loads, which would have been the better way to do it. Instead, she carried one, and half the time when you do that, what do? You drop it. Of course, you drop something, then you have to clean it up, and then you have to, you know, shampoo the carpet, and then you, and you know what? Life does this. Life does this. So we say, well, watch yourself. See if you're carrying the lazy man's load. Instead of saying, look, I'm just going to stay at this until it's done. I'm going to keep at what I know I need to do. And then afterwards I will play. Do the work. You want practical advice on life? This is God saying this. Say, oh man, it sounds like my dad. Well, you know, there's a reason that dads say this. You know, they learned it the hard way, so they try and save young people from learning it the hard way. How many of you learned it by listening to your dad? Right, exactly. So see, we're wasting our time, aren't we, as dads? I remember my dad saying stuff like this. And it's even worse when he quotes the Bible. Did your dad ever quote the Bible to you, or your mom, or whatever? Go to the end, oh sluggard, and write it on a piece of paper, tack it to the door of the bedroom, which if you open it, your life is being threatened, you know, by whatever's growing in there, you know, you don't open it, and just tack this on there. Parents use this, and kids look at it, and they think, how odd. My parents have no idea what reality is about. They do, they think this, and that's what you thought. Now, when you're older, you look at it and you go, this is in the book of Proverbs. God has been saying this all along. Isn't it interesting? Wisdom, wisdom for life. Make your life work. Watch out for rash commitments. Think well. And watch out for chronic laziness, and I mean serious, real, genuine, internal laziness. Not just the appearance of laziness, but real internal laziness, where you're not dealing with what needs to be dealt with. Here's the third thing, verses 12 to 15, and I'm going to call it internal perversity. Because I took the word right out of the New American Standard in verse 14. Perversity, it means twistedness. But it's something that's on the inside, not necessarily on the outside. Internal perversity, watch out for this. A twistedness in thinking. Verse 12, a worthless person, a wicked man. Incidentally, son of Belial is the literal Hebrew rendering. And if you have an old King James, it might render that. Anybody got an old King James that says son of Belial in there? It used to be rendered that way sometimes. One of the implications of a son of Belial, incidentally, implies living off of other people, devouring other people's lives. Isn't that interesting? A worthless person, a wicked man, is one who walks with a false mouth, there's a twistedness on the inside, who winks with his eyes, who signals with his feet, who points with his fingers. Isn't that interesting? Who with perversity, there's the word, twistedness, in his heart, internally, devises evil continually. He's always thinking, and we'll see what this means in a minute, but he's always thinking about something that he can do that isn't really exactly right, and who, by the way, spreads strife. Therefore, his calamity will come suddenly. Instantly, he'll be broken, and there'll be no healing. Internal perversity. Watch out for a twistedness on the inside in which there is a secret agenda. Now watch this. Look at verse 13. He winks with his eyes, signals with his feet, points with his fingers. Do you know what he's talking about there? He's talking about signals that people give when they're doing business, but it's not all above board. And they're kind of... The idea is a couple of crooked businessmen working a mark, a person who's buying from them, and they're using a code behind the scenes in order to get out of this person some dishonest gain. You know what he's talking about? Duplicity. He's talking about crookedness on the inside, where you don't live your life in the open, where you're always, you have a secret agenda at all times. There's a lot of vested interest in all the decisions. Lots of stuff behind the scenes in this person's life. They're tricky. And when you talk to them, you're never quite sure you're getting the full story. Do you ever know people like that? If you've done business with people like that, it's miserable. Absolutely miserable to do business with people in whose lives you can never trust that what they're telling you is true. Because you know they always have a secret agenda. There's always another reason for it. You say, well, I'm sure that never happens among pastors. You know, in pastors' lives, they never come across people like that. Think again. There's a book, an old book back from the 80s, called The People of the Lie, written by a Christian psychologist, in which he describes a type of person who essentially has lied to themselves for so long, they have secret agendas that are even secret to them. I'm not kidding you. I am not kidding you. And I tell you, you find it in Christian circles. People whose lives are so radically unchristlike and yet so profoundly, attractively religious. I want you to think that through. That's the essence of Phariseeism, the essence of it. And you say, well, this is pretty crass here where this person is very duplicitous. You know, he's got the little signal thing happening. He's got the secret agenda behind the scenes, and he's got the whole thing happening that he doesn't want anyone else to see. Is it that crass? Oh, no, 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 no. People of the lie are not crass. They are very, very polished. And they have been lying for so long that it's very difficult for people around them to even see it until you really get behind the scenes with them and maybe have to do business with them. Or you get so involved in their life that you suddenly realize, wait a minute. And it's almost scary when you find out that the person you're dealing with that you thought was this way has this entirely other agenda that they themselves do not believe is wrong because they've been lying to themselves for so long. Internal perversity. That's why I called it that. A twistedness on the inside. Watch for it as a character trait. And Christian, I say watch for it as a character trait because we need to suspect our motives sometimes for the things we say and the things we do. We Christians very often simply assume that because we are Christians, our motives are automatically pure. It doesn't say that in the Bible. It says we need to question our motives sometimes and be sure that we are not lying to ourselves about the thing we think God has told us. God spoke to me that I need to do such and so. Really? I've heard that line many, many, many times as a pastor. And often, and through the years I have learned to recognize it, often it is nothing but a covering, a pious veneer for what was really in the carnal heart to begin with. Be careful. I can't say for you, but I can tell you this. Watch out for internal perversity. Watch out for this kind of duplicity, this worthless person thing, even masquerading under religion. You can't trust this person. Here's the next thing. Now, we've looked at rash commitments. Be careful of that. Chronic laziness. Watch out for an internal laziness that's below the surface very often, but an unwillingness to deal with life straight ahead. That's laziness. You want to live successfully? Watch out for those things. And then here's the third one we just looked at. Internal perversity. Lying to ourselves. Sneaky. Having a personal agenda internally. Watch out for it. Look and be careful. Verses 16 to 19 is the next one. What I call relational disruption. Now, these are
the things God hates. This is a famous passage, the seven deadly sins, verse 16. There are six things which the Lord hates, yes, even seven, which are an abomination to him. People say, oh, my God doesn't hate anybody or anything. Well, then your God isn't the God of the Bible, I guarantee it, because he says he hates lots of stuff and lots of people. Isn't that horrible for us to hear? I mean, I did a whole deal a while back. You remember it from Psalms where I said, you know, you can make a good case for the fact that God hates sinners. I got a lot of interested comment about that. Because we don't associate the word hate with God, and yet he does. He says there are some things, and they are all behaviors. They are all behaviors that people do to each other. And he says, I hate them, and then he uses the word abomination. Huge, strong word, powerful word. It means it makes me nauseous and sick. It is revolting. Are there things that are revolting to God that human beings do? Yes. Yes. Do religious people sometimes do them? Well, read the list. I mean, sometimes when you read the list, it's like it's almost a membership thing for some groups, Christian groups. Verse 17. Haughty eyes. That's a proud look. Looking proud. Just kind of looking down. The last time I remembered the serious haughty eye thing was in high school. Between the senior lockers and the freshman lockers. Between the cream and the scum. You see it so clearly in the high school environment, sometimes in the college environment, often in the business environment. Between those with the corner offices and those who don't even have oxygen. And the goal is to move up. And when you move up and you get whatever it is, and all cultures have them, by the way, it's not just ours, all cultures have a pecking order and a prestige point. And maybe it's a corner teepee in some cultures, you know, or a corner igloo or something. But everybody has them, and when you move up, then you get to look down, which is a very pleasing thing to do to you, to look down at another person over the top of your nose, maybe even over the top of your glasses. When I got glasses, someone told me, do not get glasses you have to look over the top of. It gives you a sense of superiority, doesn't it, to look down on somebody else, to at least know that somebody else is worse off than you are, that you can look down on them in some way. And God hates that. He says it's revolting to me. And the reason is, of course, because we're all scumbags looking down on other scumbags. That's the problem, is that we really don't have an accurate appraisal of who we are, and that's what's so revolting. It's not because there's no such thing as evil in the world, and it's not because God doesn't look down on evil. He does. The problem is when we look down on it, it's evil looking down on evil. And he's going, that's really stupid. That is revolting. So he says, the proud look, that's not what I do. He says, that's not what I do. That's not the way Jesus was, who had every right to be proud in every way and associated with the humble, and when asked to describe himself, said, I am humble. Meek and humble of heart. I want you to be like me. The haughty eyes. Then he goes, the lying tongue, which is obvious. In order to sin well, you have to be good at this anyway. Lying is a behavior that is absolutely satanic. He's the father of lies. You can tell he's lying. His lips are moving. Whatever he promises is a lie. And so, consequently, we who do lie, and we all do at times for various reasons, are being like Satan when we do that. And you can't really sin successfully in any other way without being a decent liar. I've made that clear in other studies as well. Lying is essential to a truly long-term sinful lifestyle. You have to be able to lie well. And you can get good at it real quick, which is a shock to us, how easily we become accustomed. But he says, I hate that. I hate that. Why? These are behaviors. Remember, this is relational. This is how we treat other people. And he says, there are certain things about the way you treat each other that I hate. he says. I hate it when you treat each other this way. Haughty eyes, lying tongue. When you lie to each other, he says, I hate that. Hands that shed innocent blood. Notice he's using the parts of the body, and that's a kind of a, it's an artistic way for him to put it into the poetry. Eyes, tongue, hands that shed innocent blood. That means take advantage of people. And also all the way to the point of taking their life away from them or allowing it to be taken away from them when you can stop it. Hands that shed innocent blood. A heart that devises wicked plans. That means on the inside, the thinking is actually thinking of ways to hurt other people. He says, I hate that. I despise it. And you say, well, maybe you don't think that way on a regular basis. Most Christians wouldn't, although you catch yourself sometimes, don't you? Thinking evil of another person. But maybe you are close enough to what's going on in the world to realize, you know what? That's rampant in my office complex. There are people who do nothing but plan how to ruin other people's careers or how to ruin other people's businesses when they know they're making plenty of money, but they know by making a little plan here, they can drive someone else out of business for no reason at all, really, except what? You know, more, whatever. Devises wicked plans. And then feet that run rapidly to evil. Boom, 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 down the hall. Run rapidly. It's the same feeling as on Christmas, early Christmas morning before the sun comes up and little children do what down the hall? Boom, 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 boom. Feet that run rapidly. Why? Because their hearts are all excited about something. And he says, feet that run rapidly to evil. Because they're all excited about doing something really stupid and really painful. And they're all excited about it. Let's go do this. He says, that makes me sick. I hate that. All of these are behaviors in which we treat other people in certain ways. A false witness who utters lies, that's basically perjury, to say something bad about another person officially and have it stick, happens every day. Happens every day in our country. Happens in divorce court. Happens in divorce court. People lie about each other because they know the judge isn't a mind reader. And they know their lawyer might be able to make a point when in reality, when you really boil it down, it's not true. Or at least it's not true in the way it's been made to sound by the person. But that's the whole game, isn't it? That's the whole game. God says, I hate that, and I will even the score. Perjury, and then finally, the one who spreads strife among brothers. It's interesting he puts that in there. Foments strife among brothers. Causes people... He likes it. Do you ever be around a person who just isn't happy until other people are unhappy? They're just kind of always working behind the scenes to make sure everybody's a little bit on edge. And that's how they function. That's how they work, is they like other people to be on edge. They like a little fight going on. Then they can kind of get around it and get what they want. You know, people like that, you got to stay away from. And if you are people like that, if you're a person like that, and you find them in churches sometimes, you need to repent. Either that or go live by yourself in the wilderness where you can't hurt anybody. He says, I hate this. Spreading strife among brothers, causing constant friction. Let's cause a little uproar. There's too much peace here. I don't like this. Let's cause a little uproar. I can't move forward this organization without a little fighting going on. Got to get something going. God says, I hate that. Relational disruption. Relational disruption. That means how you treat each other is really lousy. Watch out for that in your relationships. If you want to live successfully and you find relational disruption going on around you all the time, and in fact, you find yourself rather adept at it, then what you need to do is you need to go to the Lord and say, Lord, my life is really screwed up about this. Would you please change me? If everybody in your life is telling you that you're really goofed up, you know what? You probably are. And if you're not listening to them, if every relationship around you is broken and trashed, and you can't maintain long-term friendships with anybody, I know it sometimes doesn't work with one or two people, or occasionally, you know, that's just human life in a sinful world. But when all of it is that way, all the time, and every place you go, you find that you can't stay because you end up getting in fights with everybody, and you've got this relational disruption going on, your life is not working. And you're not thinking like God.
And it really probably isn't everybody else's fault. Chances are, you could be, we'll just think about that. Relational disruption, and watch for these behaviors that he just puts in here, relational disruption. And then finally, verses 20 to 35, sexual promiscuity, which he repeats over and over and over again. Verses 20 and down to verse 23, he says, listen to what I'm telling you, my son, because it'll help you a lot. And it'll keep you, verse 24, keep you from the evil woman. He sort of personifies sexuality in the harlot, in the hooker, and in the adulteress. From the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Uses two terms here. You'll watch for him. He'll use harlot and adulteress, both referring to sexual immorality of different sorts. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her catch you with her eyelids. That is a great line. Catch you with her eyelids. You see, you get the picture of these giant eyelids kind of going ka-chomp, ka-chomp, ka-chomp. You know, you see this little guy running away and these eyelids chasing him, right? It's a great picture. Don't let her catch you with her eyelids. What does he mean? Well, eye contact can be an extremely sensuous thing. Eye contact. That's where a lot of trouble starts. An extra few seconds in eye contact with the wrong person over a long period of time, and you are caught by the eyelids. Isn't that interesting? On account of a harlot, a hooker, basically, one is reduced to a loaf of bread. Your life is ruined. And on account of an adulteress hunts for the precious life. You don't see it that way. It doesn't seem that way at the time. But he says that's what happens. Your life gets ruined. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Hello? Can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is the one who goes in to his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he's hungry. But when he is caught, he has to repay sevenfold, and he must give all of his substance in order to pay it back. But the one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does this. What he's saying is, if you do commit other crimes and you have to pay restitution, you can actually eventually do it, but if you do this, you'll never pay it back. You'll never pay it back. You'll put a scar on yourself that will be there. Does that mean that God does not forgive? No, I did not say that. God does forgive. But the scar, ask anybody with the scar if it was worth it, and they will all tell you, no, it wasn't worth it. And that's what he's saying. Don't ruin your life with sexual immorality. Wounds and disgrace this man will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. That means that his reputation will be ruined. Jealousy enrages a man, meaning the husband in this, the injured husband in this case, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance, and he will not accept any ransom, nor will he be content though you give him many gifts. You will not be able to buy this guy off if you violate his wife. And now, chapter 7 goes on with this, and we'll talk more about it next week, but it picks up on the whole issue. Sexual promiscuity, watch out for it. He says, you want to live well? Watch out for these character flaws. Rash commitments, chronic laziness, internal perversity, lying to yourself, relational disruption, where you can't keep peace in your relationships, and sexual promiscuity. Incidentally, our world, of course, thinks that sexual immorality and promiscuity is not a problem, and our world is kidding itself. They say, well, look at President Clinton got away with it. Yes and no. Yes and no. You watch the current elections. Anybody who has a hope of being elected is going to say something about President Clinton, and it's not going to be nice. Even his own vice president has had to distance himself from Slick Willie. You know, the situation, it does not pay off. It does not pay off. And this president will go down in history, even though in his private life he may very well repent. Truly and truly, he may. But he will go down in history as an immoral, godless, untrustworthy president. And he has all of the debates about, you know, the presidency have to do with character now. Have you noticed that? All of the words that everybody wants to get elected, they're all talking about restoring character to the presidency. He did not win anything. He retained his title and lost everything that's on the inside. And his mentor, Kennedy, whose finaglings and shenanigans have come out even recently, more and more. We discovered that when that oak tree fell, it was also rotten in the middle. And people know it. And some even speculate that he lost his life, literally, as a result of some of that. So don't be fooled. Don't be fooled by all the sitcoms on television that say, oh yeah, sexual immorality is no big deal. It is a big deal. I don't care what television says. It matters to wise people, and it matters to God. So he says, watch out for the tendency towards sexual immorality. Watch out for your sex drive. And we'll talk about it again next week. So stay tuned. It's always a popular subject. I tell you, I get more comments when I talk about sex. So let me turn this around a little bit. One of the ways that you can apply Proverbs, by the way, is to look at what it's saying and then turn it around and say, okay, say this in a positive way. Let me give you 5 pieces of advice based on what we've looked at. You want to make your life work? Try these 5 things. They are basically taking what we just looked at, turning it around, and making them into positive pieces of advice. Number 1, learn to apologize effectively. You want to live well? Learn to apologize effectively and get yourself out of a mess. People who do not know how to apologize and say, I was wrong, please forgive me, can we work this out, never are happy in the long run. Learn to apologize. There's a good piece of advice from the first 5 verses here. Go to your neighbor and make it right. What he's saying? Learn to apologize. Number 2, pull your own weight. That's in the thing about not being lazy. Pull your own weight wherever you go. Don't be too proud to pitch in at any level, anywhere, anytime, with any group. Pull your weight. Work hard. In fact, that's a biblical admonition in Thessalonians, Paul's earliest letters. Both of the Thessalonian letters have exhortations to work hard. And that doesn't mean never retire. In fact, most of the retired people I know work really hard. They just work at something they want to do instead of something they had to do, but they still work hard and try and live productive lives. And that's what this is getting at. Live a productive life. It doesn't mean you have to have a 9-to-5 job. It means that the energy of your daily life has to be focused in a productive way. Work and pull your weight. And if you're not pulling your weight in your relationships and in your life, if you're not seeking to make a productive, purposeful addition to the community, to the people you live with, if you're just living off of them, my friend, you're living unwisely. So he says, pull your own weight. Number 3, keep your life on the table instead of under it. When you're doing business, whether it's money business or whether it's any kind of interaction, keep your life on the table. Do not have secret agendas. Live in the open. Keep your life on the table and not under it. Do business over the top of the table, not under it. Deceit is not a management tool for a Christian. Either emotionally or financially, we automatically think, you know, management tool must be business. But there's more to it than that. Some people manage their whole lives by deceit. Their only way of functioning is to never tell the whole truth to the people around them, so they always keep them a little bit off. And that's how they get what they want. It's godless. Don't do it. Keep your life on the table instead of under it. Here's number 4, promote unity. Everywhere you go, do and say the things that ease the relationships rather than strain them. See, what that does is it takes verses 16 to 19, the 7 deadly sins, and it turns them around into a positive command. Wherever you go, make life easier on the people around you. Don't strain the relationships. Ease the relationships. Let me give you a good illustration of this. There's a young woman who recently was married,
And I heard this secondhand, but I know it's true, who, in the process, she and her husband had been arguing about something, as often happens. And she said to him, "Don't put the wooden utensils in the dishwasher, because the wooden handles are ruined by the hot, soapy water in the dishwasher." But he wanted to help her, and he kept helping her and helping her, but kept forgetting that he was supposed to hand wash these. He kept doing it over and over and over, even though she reminded him and reminded him. So you know what she decided to do? It's a classic example of what I'm talking about here, make life easy on the people around you. She said, "I have decided," when someone else asked her about this, and they noticed she was putting the wooden stuff in the dishwasher. And they said, "Why are you doing that?" She said, "I know it ruins the handles, but I've made a decision. As the handles break, I'm going to replace them with other utensils that don't have wooden handles, because my husband wants to help me, and that's more valuable to me than the wooden handles." And I thought, well, good for this young lady. That is a classic piece of daily, tiny little decision, just a tiny decision to say a $2 knife is not worth a fight with my husband when he's trying to help me anyway. And I have just made this decision. I don't care. That's it. That's done. I'll put him in there. I'll put him in there. I'm just not going to bring it up anymore. You see, when people make those kinds of decisions for each other over a long period of time, promotes unity, and it's the opposite of the seven deadly sins. And these are daily little things that you do. You just kind of do them. You just kind of make it work. Number five. So number four is promote unity. Number five, say no to yourself, especially about sex. Say no to yourself about sex. Say no to yourself about sex. You say, "Well, I don't have to listen to that, Rick. I'm a married person." Oh, yeah? Think again. One of the great myths among young unmarried people is that after they get married, they don't have to control their sex drive. That is a huge, ridiculous myth. Because sex will always have to be controlled, and you will always have to say no to yourself. Simply being married and having a healthy sex life does not mean that you never say no to yourself. Does not mean that you don't limit what you watch, what you hear, where you go, who you hang out with. You will always have to do that. One of the things that gets men in trouble is that they actually live under that myth that after they get married, they will not have to ever say no to themselves. And it's terrible. If a guy lives that way over a long period of time, his wife feels completely used. And if he doesn't learn to say no in literature, in the things he reads and looks at, movies and so on, it'll still run his life. The sex drive is huge and powerful, and it's good. It's like this powerful horse, but if you don't ride it, it will ride you. It will ruin your life, men and women. So, say no. No. Practice it. And if you haven't, if you're thinking to yourself, "Well, you know, I can handle this or that or the other thing or this or that stimulus that the world offers," and it's just pouring it on all the time, think again. If you aren't actively saying no to yourself sexually, I guarantee you, I don't care if you are ecstatically happily married, if you're not actively saying no to yourself in some areas sexually, there's trouble. Trouble in your mind, if nowhere else. People say, "Well, I can't be sued for what I'm thinking." True. On earth. On earth. But you're not a citizen here. You're a citizen in another country. And in that country, my friend, let me tell you, you can be sued for what you're thinking. And your Heavenly Father knows what you're thinking. You want to live well, learn to apologize, pull your own weight, keep your life on the table, not under it, promote unity wherever you go, and say no to yourself, especially about sex.